Hey everybody, welcome back to the Sarah Brillo podcast. And today I am extremely excited to have Charlotte Bayer here with me. Charlotte.
I don't know if Charlotte Bayer needs that much of a da-da, but thank you.
So Charlotte is the founder of the Institute for Private Investors and is also president of her own private foundation, the Principal Quest Foundation. Thanks for being here. Do you want to maybe just, before we dive into the exciting topic today of how to communicate with empathy so you don't sound tacky. Yes, that is actually going to be the title of this show, everybody. Charlotte, tell us, what are you working on nowadays?
Oh, well, that's a great opening question because I'm right in the midst of doing it, in fact. When I sold my company 8 years ago, IPI, I made the decision that I wanted to really make a difference in the world of women and created this private foundation, Principal Quest Foundation. And to date, now we have held 12 retreats for 10 women of all ages and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. And it's been a joy. But it's very connected to IPI in this way. It's all about building community and creating connections with people.
So, yeah, that's great. I love that. So tell me more about how you help them create connections with people, because that kind of plays into what we're going to talk about today. But so you help the women that you work with, you help them to create connections with who?
First, each other.
Right.
And more importantly, probably first with themselves. And the way to do that is to allow for a pretense-free, as I call it, environment. Which means that we're not going to just talk superficially, but we're going to get to the heart of the matter. And we're going to...
That is a tweetable term, Charlotte. Pretense-free. Sorry.
Well, exactly. And what that means is the leader or facilitator needs to create that environment, whether it's in an hour-long event or, in my case, an entire weekend retreat.
Beautiful. I love that. I love that. That really is the key to success, no matter if you're, you know, for the women that you work with, for the advisors that we're talking to on this podcast, and really for anybody in the business world and also in your social life. But today what we're going to talk about is advisors. How are you communicating with the affluent people that you want to reach? Because I know this from being a consultant to this industry, that many times, I see it in so many ways, Charlotte, chime in here, but I feel like in the messaging directly to them, the pitching, the pitch books, the websites, the social media, a lot of times I feel like it's really kind of peripheral. It's not really connecting with them. It's not empathizing with them. And like you were saying, I think it's full of pretense. And I also think that can kind of make people uncomfortable a little bit, you know, by not really understanding them. I don't know. Do you agree with me?
I totally agree. I'd go even further with perhaps exaggerated language and say that from what investors tell me, too often the advisor is just downright boring.
Mm.
And they'll say, oh no, another presentation where they go through a flip book or they pepper me with questions or they go from what seems and hears just like a script that every other firm they're talking to seems to have the same script.
It's awful. I think it's awful for the advisors too. When I was an advisor, I remember I worked at this one company and they had this like whole thing you had to go through and it was like, and you had to memorize it.
Yeah, but you see, man. It all stems from fear, which is why we don't often show our vulnerable or authentic self, because it stems from fear. And who can blame an advisor for being afraid? They're talking to a prospective client. They're hoping that they'll be able to win this prospective client's assets. And there's a lot riding on it. So it's safer often from the firm's point of view to have it memorized as a script. What I think most advisors are learning very rapidly today, however, is that that is a killer. That doesn't win the business. What wins the business is finding that point of connection and not doing it by asking a simplistic question like, well, what's your investment goal? But it's rather going a little deeper and yet doing it in a timely way and not an inappropriate or invasive way.
Yeah, I hear you, because and for the advisors out there that are listening to this, I think the really important thing is to ask the right questions.
Yeah. And I go a step further, Sarah, and say that you need to perhaps be gentle by saying, here are questions others have often asked us. Or where would you like to begin this meeting? What's most important to you as you interview a potential advisor?
Yeah, because that takes the pressure off, and it does indicate an honest willingness to listen.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And willingness to listen. Now, remember that sometimes that doesn't work. So most smart advisors end up having two or three questions in their toolkit. So there's always an escape hatch for the prospective client if they don't feel like answering the first one. They could also say that something like, many of our clients today began by asking us about X, or it could be, you know, our investment returns or our client reports. And that gives the prospective client a chance to say, yeah, I want to hear about that.
Right. See, it's a very delicate balance, because you don't want to, it's like you want to get them to open up, and you want to do that right away, because I think we've all been through those meetings that are, you know, when the person is a little bit on the defensive. Awful for the client, awful for the advisor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just painful all the way around. But at the same, you want to get them to open up, but at the same time, you don't want to be too general. You don't want to be small talking.
Right.
You need to show your value.
Exactly. I think you need to throw small talk out the window and do that either or, so that, you know, that helps. But there's another thing that will really, I think, put everyone at greater ease, and that is beginning the meeting by saying, we want this meeting to address what you want to hear about us. So often I will ask prospective clients what they want me to focus on. Some will say performance, some will say client reports. Do you have a particular way you'd like us to approach this? I urge advisors not to pull out the pitch book, not to give the macro, not to use any of the cliches that might already be in the brochure of not only their firm, but every other firm. Everyone says they're client-centric. I mean, investors...
I use that in my cliche blog, client-centric. Like, business is the definition of business is the client is the one that's cutting the check, so obviously they get the attention. That's what you pay attention.
Well, but let's be careful. Let's be careful, because while, yes, they're obviously cutting the checks, it is a business and it has to make a profit, or it won't stay in business. And then all those happy clients will be unhappy clients because they won't have a firm anymore to depend on. Mm-hmm. I think that the sooner that is clear and stated to all clients, that there are going to be times where you're not going to agree or be happy with us. And there may be times where we wish you would listen more to us. But let's at least own that and say it might happen, and then discuss, well, what will we do then? By saying things like that, you'll do what I think all classic good salespeople do, which is you want to get the next meeting. You don't want to win the account, because winning the account too quickly means it's not going to last. They'll be just as quick to ditch you. But if your real goal is to get another meeting, to want them to hear more or want to come back and see you again, because after all, they're going to see you for a lifetime, we hope, if you are able to win them as a client.
Right. So talk a little bit about the soft skills, the so-called soft skills.
Oh, that's my favorite subject. And I must confess, I early on identified soft skills as a biased way of looking at what has historically been seen as feminine skill. And that's empathy, listening, nurturing, caring, caregiver, and so on. And yet, let's face it, it's not just the purview of women. Anyone can exhibit empathy. It's a question of intention and saying, is this what this client wants me to exhibit right now? Those soft skills, I think, are critical. But let's also be very honest and say that not every firm, senior leadership, or portfolio managers are, you know, swimming around in empathy and soft skills. Many of them are far more analytical, more cerebral. And so what smart firms do, in my view, is they make sure that they identify who has what skills and match it up with a particular situation with a client or a prospective client.
Give me an example.
Well, the best example I can think of is a family was looking for a new advisor and interviewed four different firms. And this particular second generation told me that he liked one firm far better than any of the others because they were much more analytical. They showed him all the process. They showed him how they look at, you know, asset allocation and all sorts of fancy words. Whereas his aunt, his mother, and his sister and brother all liked a firm that was much more emphasizing the soft skills. What he came to realize is that it wouldn't matter that he liked that one firm better, because if the rest of the family never wanted to see them, couldn't stand listening to them, fell asleep listening to their view of the macro environment and the Fed funds rate, he said, I have to go with the firm, because in a sense, in his mind, they were pretty much equal, but it was their style of relating. And if a firm can identify what type of client is going to most enjoy the style their senior people have, that's the real secret.
Well, this is something that is going to be increasingly important as the role of technology within the profession continues to expand. With robo-advisors and fee compression, advisors are scratching their heads about, well, how am I going to justify my 1%? How am I going to show my value versus a betterment? And it's something that is really a worry, especially as the wealth gets handed down to the Gen Xers and the Gen Yers.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid I'm not very optimistic on that 1% fee because I believe, for the most part, it's a bogus and illogical way to charge. I think it's far smarter to charge on complexity and on time and effort spent. And I'd say about a third, or maybe just shy of a third, of the investors I'm familiar with much prefer a retainer or project-based fee. It can be renegotiated every few years, but they simply find assets under management fee, whether it's 1% or 60%, 60 basis points, to be just crazy, because every family's different. Some need far more hand-holding, far more attention and service than others. And the question that investors who speak to me ask is, why would I pay the same in fees for my 50 million as someone with 50 million over here who has 35 family members and, you know, 16 different trusts, whereas I have two accounts, my wife and I. So I think that the days of AUM fees are over. They began to show that. And robo merely accelerated the trend.
Right. Yes, but at the same time, I think that the retainer fee model, while it does have its merits, also is going to need to, I mean, I feel like that's still in beta testing, you know?
But here's the thing, Sarah, you can make a retainer fee that might end up being in basis points exactly what you would have charged anyway. But you position it and you introduce it in such a way that it's more of a logical way to fee than the assets under management.
Right. In terms of the value that you're providing and how that better aligns with the fee that they would be paying.
Yeah.
So I see what you're saying. Yeah. Now, what are your 10 principles of principle?
Well, that came to me thanks to the members of IPI whom I watched and observed for many years and saw there were certain ones that were delighted with the relationship with their advisors and others that were unhappy or were constantly switching managers or advisors. And so I tried to write up these principles of principle, as I call them, and I showed them to a few of the investors who I deemed to be very successful at overseeing their wealth using advisors and money managers, more than a dozen in many cases. And I said, what do you think? And they said, yeah, that's it. And the first and most important one, Sarah, is self-awareness. If a client is not self-aware and doesn't understand herself or himself and the need for control or the need for constant handholding, it's not going to be a successful relationship if the firm doesn't not only see that, but together they recognize what are the implications for their relationship.
Can I just stop you right there, Charlotte? I love that comment because in one of the articles I wrote about the disconnect between advisors and affluent people, one of the people said, this was a partner at a big law firm. Like you would know the name of the law firm, right? I interviewed him and he said that he has a lot of trouble actually getting his risk tolerance right because when he's in the meeting, like, I don't know if you remember this comment, right?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so you know what I'm going to say, but just for those of you who haven't read it, it's on my website, actually, Total Disconnect. That's the title of the article. You can Google it. But the guy says that he's so distracted by his job that he can't even understand his risk tolerance questionnaire. Like he can't really think hard about what it means, the objectives and the risk, and because the pressures of everyday life get in the way. Those were his words.
Yeah. And I would even go a step further and say most of the answers to those questionnaires and all those interview samples that are done, people inadvertently, unconsciously perhaps, they simply don't tell the truth. And that's why the exercise in my book on quadrants and sophistication and control can ferret out the need for control or the lack of sophistication or the overconfidence in their own ability to manage their own affairs.
Wait, hold on. Tweetable moment here. What's that book called? Just for the listeners here.
It's called Wealth Management Unwrapped. It's revised and expanded to include a chapter called Women with Wallets, as well as the robo trend. And it has a lot of exercises for investors, but it also not only has the 10 principles of principle, Sarah, but it includes a corollary on each principle for advisors. So they can be sort of in sync with this new partnership that they are creating with every client.
Right. Okay.
So the other surprising principle of principle you might find surprising anyway is that investors find that the 10th principle of principle, or the last one, is that successful wealth management should actually free up your time, should free you up to do what you love and what you want to do. It shouldn't bog you down. And I believe that that's the myth, that if someone is really a do-it-yourselfer, and I use the Home Depot example, if you really love renovating, doing your own kitchen, doing your own bathroom renovation, fine, go do it. But that's not an ideal client for most advisors. Do-it-yourselfers tend to be just a conflict-ridden, tension-filled relationship. Whereas if you work with a client and realize they may have been a do-it-yourselfer, but now perhaps because of their aging, they realize they need help. They need someone else to really be in charge. That certainly happened for me after I sold my business. At first I thought, okay, I can do this all by myself. I should know what I'm doing. But it's like the shoemaker's daughter. I realized, no, I probably can't do this myself, especially as I get older.
Right. I think a lot of people say that.
Yeah.
They said it in my article. One guy said, you know, I could, if it's just a matter of playing with my portfolio, I could do that. I'm looking for someone to liberate time, not consume my time. But yet,
yes.
I feel as if advisors sometimes when they come across when their websites and their marketing brochures, which by the way, advisors listening to this podcast, repeat after me, rip up the marketing brochures. Rip up the marketing brochures. I actually, you know how much money I have lost because I refuse, how many clients because I refuse to do marketing brochures? They come to me all the time. They're like, we want to revise the marketing brochure. I'm like, eh, YouTube video. Sometimes they pay for it, sometimes they don't, but I cannot ethically play a part in doing that for them.
Yeah. Well, but at the same time, the role of a marketing brochure can be like some other industries use, which is what clients most value about our firm. You then turn it into a third-party endorsement without having, you know, the names, of course, but what clients most value, or what solution we provided for one couple. In other words, it's more anecdotal based, it's story based, and I know you've written about this, Sarah, many times, but we're all human animals, and so we like to know, okay, what are other people doing? Just like we love the Amazon thing. Well, if you bought that, you'd like this.
Right.
I think that's the way a marketing brochure can succeed, because then I can begin to identify with the people that are talked about anonymously in a brochure, and I'm not spending, you know, eye-shutting time reading, you know, 150 years of combined experience. Everyone has experience, or they wouldn't even be in the running.
Or my comprehensive financial planning. That's the other. It's so it's really comprehensive, so comprehensive that they're all doing it. Okay, yeah, I know, I hear you on that, because, and you know, Charlotte, I love this point you're making, because if you notice on social media, and I love the Amazon example, this is one of the reasons social media is so popular, because people are naturally curious about what the other person out there is getting. And you see, advisors can't do that online because they can't do testimonials. And sometimes even comments on their content is prohibited. A lot of the broker dealers like will cut that off. But if you notice, people do trust more what a Yelp review says about a school, like for me, a daycare, like if there's anyone on Yelp, because I'm not as nuts over certain things as a lot of people, but one thing I'm crazy over is my kids. Like, me and Antonio are nuts. So anytime we have to put them in a daycare or babysitter, like, we scour for any information. And so if anyone on Yelp is like, this daycare was like mean to my kid, I'm like, And that's just it. It could be completely invalid. This person could be completely lying or drunk or whatever when they put that up there. But I'm like, nope, a peer said it. Like, this is not a paid advertisement. This is not somebody from the company saying it. This is not a testimonial that the company is claiming that somebody said about the company. This is directly from the horse's mouth. I would trust that more.
Yeah, and yet there's nothing like that today, except in some of the private networks where people can ask each other, what do you think of this advisor? What do you think of this hedge fund, private equity fund of funds, and so on. And yet even that, in my view, needs to have a second level of due diligence so that the prospective client makes sure that that isn't someone who just isn't smart enough to see the problem. I mean, witness Bernie Madoff. I mean, there were a lot of very, very smart people who invested with Bernie Madoff.
Yeah. And so although there isn't a real public forum, you know, like Rate My Advisor kind of a thing online.
Many have tried, Sarah, since, you know, when I first entered the industry in 1991 with IPI, many people have tried. Tried to have a Rate My Advisor, and the closest thing to it might be some of the media top advisors in this, top independent advisors, top women advisors, and yet you and I both know, and most advisors do as well, and increasingly the prospective clients know too, that this is not exactly the metrics it should be looked at. Like, it shouldn't be necessarily true that the best advisor is the one who's growing the fastest or has the biggest account size or the most assets under management. That is not necessarily the real metric a lot of investors are looking for. They're looking for how happy are the clients, and that's notoriously unreliable because nobody likes filling out surveys, least of all ultra high net worth investors.
Well, do you know how many advisors, and I'm not faulting them for it, I think just as business people, we get so caught up in the day-to-day, But do you know how many people, just in business, advisors specifically, that don't know why the client is actually with them? They don't know what makes the client happy about them. And so whenever we do a branding exercise, people come to me, I want to rebrand, I want to get a competitive advantage. I say, okay, so why do you, I tell them to ask the question this way. Go to your toughest client. And I mean, we all have this one, right? The person that you know has thought about firing you. Maybe they've even said it, but yet for some reason they've stayed with you. That person is actually your most valuable promoter because they probably don't like much about you, but if there's one thing they like about you, it's probably pretty strong because it's been convincing enough for them to stay despite all the shortfalls that they perceive in you. And so I just encourage people to say to that person, hey, look, there have been times when I'm sure you, and I mean, it takes some guts to say this, so maybe don't say it this way, but there have been times when I'm sure you haven't been thrilled. We both know this, but what has it that's led you to hang on? Or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. But And Sarah, I think that is a wonderful idea. And I might even include another question in that same conversation, which would be, and what about things that we might do or recalibrate slightly to make an even stronger relationship with you? Because asking that question does not put you on the defensive, nor does it put them on the defensive, but it gives them an opportunity to voice something that might be really annoying. It could be something very small, like, you know, we don't need to spend 2 hours at our meetings when we go over the reports. We only really, we could do it on Zoom. We could do it here, there, or whatever. So asking how might we adjust or recalibrate slightly to make our relationship, our partnership even more effective could be a nice way to begin that conversation, followed by your very wonderful idea of, you know, asking the toughest clients, you know, what's inspired you to hang in there?
Or just even the ones that aren't even tough, like as people get to know you and you've worked with them for a little bit, say to them, what is it that you like? And don't accept it if they say, oh, I trust you, I'm comfortable with you, I feel that you'll always
ask. You could ask, what prompted you to trust me? And sometimes, unfortunately, they'll say, because, you know, Joe Blow told me that you were good, and so I trust Joe, which is the Bernie Madoff syndrome.
And but that's at first after they've worked together. I mean, not after they've worked together. Like, that's, you know, I'm saying, like, after you've worked together for a while.
Yeah, that's very true, very true.
What is it that you trust now, given our experience together?
Yeah, salespeople are taught very, very rigidly. And one of the things I remember being taught years ago was don't go past the sale. So that saying, why are you hiring us, would be unconscionable. It would be breaking all the rules. And yet, that could be a question to ask a brand new client. What prompted you to hire us? Who else did you interview? How did we differ from them? That is golden information and data for you to use in the next prospective meeting. And it often reaffirms their reasons for hiring you for both them and yourself.
It is an affirmation. And by the way, it makes you look not desperate when you say those things.
Exactly.
Because you're opening yourself up to the risk that they will say something that makes you uneasy or them uneasy. It shows bravery and courage. By the way,
doing that, you've clarified a misunderstanding, which is a better time to figure it out then than later.
Tell me about it, girlfriend. All right. So listen, Shaw, we got to go because Zoom is about to kick us out here. But
okay.
Thank you so much. This was so valuable. We should do something again in the future. And anyways, for everyone listening, please follow Charlotte online and listen to what she says, because I really think that she is a gem. She knows it from the inside. And I think that I hope that you've enjoyed this podcast, but I think that in the future, definitely stay in touch with Charlotte. You can find her on LinkedIn. And also, by the way, it'd be cool if you could subscribe, rate, and review this podcast show. Thanks, everybody. Tuning out now. Bye.
Thank you, Sarah.
Bye-bye. All righty. You bet. Bye.